This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. For many of us, the holidays are a time to come together with family. So we're going to begin today with a discussion about families and about the lifelong influence that siblings exert on each other. In this case, we're talking specifically about brothers.
Throughout history, the often thin line between love and rivalry among brothers has shaped the world, from Cain and Abel to the Marx brothers, from the Kennedys and the Van Goghs to the Thoreaus. Fraternal bonds are enduring and powerful and fraught with complexity.
Western Massachusetts writer George Howe Colt parallels the experiences of these iconic brothers with those of his own in his latest book, Brothers, George Howe Colt on his brothers and brothers in history. George Howe Colt, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me here.
Can you imagine who you'd be if you hadn't grown up in a family of four brothers?
Well, I think there's two parts to that question, and one is, can I imagine growing up without siblings? I don't think I can, but growing up in a family of four brothers as opposed to a mixed family, mixed with siblings, I don't know what it would have been like, but it would have been very, very different. I think that growing up among four brothers affected my life in all sorts of ways.
Mm. You know, you're the second of four brothers, and you cite in the book a great study which found that the average pair of siblings between the ages of 3 and 7 engages in an extended squabble every 17 minutes.
Well, that seems far too infrequent, if my own childhood was any indication. But one of the things that's interesting is that brother-brother combinations are the most rivalrous of all, the most contentious of all the different sibling combinations.
Yeah.
And when siblings are born closer in age, if their ages are closer together, they tend to be more rivalrous than brothers or sisters that are spaced more widely apart. So in our family, I think we had four brothers, three of whom were born within 5 years. So we were a sort of petri dish for sibling rivalry, I would say.
And it was rivalry over your parents' affection, food at the table, attention, I mean, whatever it was.
Yes. Well, I think everything we were rivalrous over, whether it was the plastic decoder ring at the bottom of the cereal box for which we squabbled mightily, yeah, or the extra piece of pie at the table, I think that we never would have known it at the time, but it all sort of led back to mommy and daddy, I'm sure, and perhaps mommy most of all. Those other things that siblings squabble over all are representations of parental attention, I would say.
There's a nice passage on page 15 about this. I'm wondering if you could read that.
Oh, sure. I'd be glad to. Part of the reason I craved attention was that with three young boys in one house, I harbored the suspicion that there might not be enough to go around, and I'd better make sure I got my fair share, or preferably a little more. Harry, Ned, and I rarely fought physically, but there seemed to be nothing we didn't contest. Who found the most foil-wrapped chocolate eggs in the backyard on Easter? Who collected the most Halloween candy? Who could make a popsicle last the longest? Who got the first look at the Sears Christmas catalog? Who got the Sunday funnies first? Who had the best godparents, as defined by whose godparents gave the best presents? Stakes were especially high at the dinner table. Who got the biggest chicken breast? Who got the biggest piece of bacon on his cheese dream? Who got the largest slice of pie? Who got praised for turning in a soldier's plate? Who ended up holding the biggest end of the wishbone? Our Holy Grail was the prize at the bottom of the cereal box. In theory, it went to the brother into whose bowl it was poured during the natural order of things, which meant that each of us usually gulped down two helpings in hopes of eating our way to the prize. In practice, things were more elemental. Ned soon deduced that he could improve his odds by shaking the cereal box upside down before filling his bowl, so the prize might resettle near the top. Whereupon I took to reaching directly into the box, digging down through the sticky layers of sugar smacks till my fingers found the plastic gee-gaw that rested near the bottom. Eventually, Ned and I cut to the chase, sneaking into the kitchen to rip open a new box of cereal before we'd finished the old one and fish out the sought-after treasure, which was abandoned as soon as it had been brandished in the losing brother's face.
That's George Howe Colt reading from his new book, Brothers, George Howe Colt on his brothers and brothers in history. And how is it now? You're all grown up. I mean, those rivalries, I mean, in a way, they sort of mark you forever, but you grow out of them and they kind of become something else as you grow older? Or how would you describe that?
They must become something else, because where could all that energy and testosterone go?
This is what I'm wondering.
You know, these days, I would say for the last 20 or 30 years, we're still very, very competitive, but we've learned to modify and moderate it. So on the tennis court, we're actually happy when a brother hits a good shot, even if he's on the opposing team. When I was young, and we'd all used to play tennis, I would pray for my brother on the opposite side to double fault. I no longer do that. So I think that's a healthy thing. But that's not to say we aren't still fiercely competitive. In my own personal experience, I'm still competitive outside the family more than I am, I would say, inside the family. But I've learned how to be more polite about it, I think.
Interesting. So when you were young, your older brother, Harry, occupied a very special place in your life. And you really begin the book with this great description. He was big. He was smart. He was generous. He was caring. He was a great athlete. He was your hero, in a word. And you'd pretty much do anything with him and go anywhere with him, right?
Yes. He was everything that I wanted to be. And yeah. He was so, which made it a little more difficult. He was so nice to me. He never said, let's ditch him when he was out with his friends. He never left me behind, and that made him even more wonderful and even more worthy of emulation, I would say.
Well, there's a great image of you two sitting in, I guess, your parents' car after your brother convinced you to run away with him.
Yes.
Yeah, so how did that work out?
Well, Harry to this day doesn't really remember running away, but I remember it vividly that the night before, I think he may have mentioned something, but the next morning he was still in his pajamas and he woke me up and he beckoned me to come downstairs with him, and we went into the garage where we sat in the car, and he had packed his strongbox in which he used to keep his baseball cards. He'd filled it with saltines and then left out the other baseball cards and just took his favorite Red Sox baseball cards. And we sat in the car, and I didn't know what was going to happen. I was probably 6 at the time, and he was 8. And in my mind, he could have done anything. So I assumed that perhaps he was going to somehow drive that car away somewhere. And I was only too happy to go with him. But a while later, we smelled the smell of bacon that my father came downstairs to cook. And Harry sort of sheepishly opened the car door, and I followed him back inside. So we didn't run away after all.
The smell of bacon, it's influenced many people to do even more dramatic things than abandon a plan to run away. That's great. I'm interested, though, in that relationship, because you mentioned your older brother was 8, you were 6. At that point in your life, that's a huge difference.
But, yes.
I mean, of course, now you're identical contemporaries. But how did that imprinting of older brother from those early years, how does it affect who you are today?
Well, I think that there's a psychologist named Francis Schachter who in the 60s or 70s identified something called sibling de-identification. And that basically says that in our adolescent years, we look at our older sibling and say, either I want to be just like him or her, or I need to find my own space. I'm going to de-identify. I'm going to do, if not just the opposite, something very, very different. And I think for my early years, I wanted to be Harry. I wanted to be to do everything he did. And then as we grew into adolescence, which I write about in the book, he started going in a direction that I wasn't sure that I wanted to follow. So I sort of went aggressively in a very different direction. And I was, what the psychologist would have said, de-identifying. In order to find out who I was and to create space in my family, I had to be different than Harry.
I see.
And of course, I had a younger brother. I had 2 younger brothers then, but the one who was just below me was somebody who I could also look at and say, well, do I want to be like him? As a middle child, I had options. I like to think I was sort of a common denominator, that I could sort of go in one direction or the other. Mm. And I think I ended up sort of going in both directions.
Well, as we mentioned, this is part memoir, but it's also great history. You write about such a diverse array of iconic brothers. And let me just ask you about a couple of them. Tell us about what you learned about the Marx brothers and how their brotherly bonds played out in their lives.
Well, it's interesting because the Marx brothers, first of all, there were 5 of them. People usually only recognize that there were 3 of them, Groucho, Harpo, and Chico. But of course, there was Gummo and Zeppo as well. And Zeppo was, I think, 9 years younger than the 4th youngest Marx brother. But when I started to read about them, I wanted to write about how brothers work together and how did these 5 Marx brothers get along on stage. Of course, usually there were only 3 and sometimes 4 of them, but they divided into pairs, essentially. Harpo and Chico, who were the eldest, were off on their own in their own world, and Groucho was in the middle, and then Gummo and Zeppo brought up the rear, and they paired off. So Groucho was left all alone as the middle child. He wasn't as good looking as his older or younger brothers. He wasn't as athletic as his older brothers. And what was he going to do? So he developed his wit. He developed words. He was an avid reader of all the Marx brothers. And he essentially, to get the attention of their mother, who adored Chico, he developed a sort of stinging wit that, of course, he later became known for in his work.
Another set of brothers that you examine is a study of completely opposite outcomes, and this theme really interests me. Edwin Booth became one of the greatest actors of the 19th century. His brother, John Wilkes Booth, assassinated President Lincoln. So this theme of siblings coming from identical circumstances but going in completely different directions, what intrigued you about that and about the Booth story?
Well, when I was young, I was fascinated by the Civil War. And one of the books that my parents had on their coffee table was a large book about the Civil War, which ended with, of course, the assassination. And it fascinated me to read that John Wilkes Booth, whom I well knew from my history classes, had a brother who had been the greatest Shakespearean actor of the 19th century.
So fascinating.
And I thought, when I was 9 or 10 and I realized this, I thought, well, are my brothers and I going to be that different? I can't imagine that. Harry and I are so close, and Ed and I have so much in common. How could any two brothers end up doing such wildly divergent things? And of course, history is full of brothers who have taken opposite tacks. And in looking at the Booth brothers, what fascinated me was figuring out how they became so different. And really, I think one of the main reasons they ended up so differently is because they essentially grew up in two different families. Their father was one of the great actors of his time. And Edwin Booth, who was older than John Wilkes, went on the road at the age of 12 with his father and traveled all across the country and served as his father's dresser. Now, his father was also an alcoholic and also had mental problems, and Edwin's main job was keeping him sober and sane for his shows and then fetching him from the bars after the shows and bringing him home. So Edwin grew up very, very early and quickly and was like an old man by the age of 20. John Wilkes Booth, on the other hand, stayed behind on the family farm in Bel Air, Maryland, with his mother and his two sisters and a younger brother. And he was his parents' favorite child. He was cosseted, he was spoiled, and he was taught to believe that the world was his oyster. So he grew up, he essentially never grew up. I mean, he died, I think, at the age of 26, but he was really a child when he died. He was brought up to believe that greatness would be his. Hmm. And so while there was a fair amount of sibling rivalry among those two Booths, because, of course, John Wilkes Booth became perhaps the second most well-known actor of his era, while there was rivalry, there was also a great deal of love between them. But they'd grown up in such different circumstances and were sort of trained to become two very different things. Now, of course, there would be many other ways to gain fame and notoriety than assassinating President Lincoln. But John had grown up in the South, in a really a southern state, Maryland, and Edwin had grown up in the North and in on the West Coast, where he'd made his acting chops. So,
well, this idea that brothers can end up in such different places, I mean, of course, you and your brothers grew up in the same household, very close in age, but was there anything like that kind of divergence? I'm not asking if one of your brothers grew up to assassinate a president, but
thankfully not.
Yes. But was there anything like some kind of divergence of path, I guess?
Well, one of the things that psychologists have been looking at over the past 20 years is how even in circumstances, unlike the Booths, which is so clear-cut of growing up into essentially two different families, that psychologists today would say that every child, even in the most sort of close-knit family, even the most geographically centered family, grows up in a different family, essentially. A different micro-environment is what they call it. And certainly in my family, we grew up in different circumstances, and I can only look back and see that now. We moved a lot when I was a child, so we sort of came of age in different places. We also grew up, I was born in 1954, and so my older brother and my next younger brother grew up just as the 60s were beginning to sort of wreak havoc and peace and love and other things among Americans, whereas my youngest brother, Mark, was born in 1962. So he also grew up in that, but at a different time and different impacts. So I definitely think we all grew up in sort of slightly different families as well, even though our family was very close.
Interesting. You know, we mentioned how competition and rivalry is one of the sort of pervasive themes in family. And you write about one of the worst brotherly rivalries between the Kellogg brothers, right?
Yes.
And this is of the famous Kellogg cereal family,
yes.
right? So
yes.
tell us about these brothers.
Well, the younger brother, Will Kellogg, was eventually the CEO of Kellogg's. And his older brother, John Harvey Kellogg, who was 8 years older than he was the proprietor of the sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan, that T. Corison Boyle writes so beautifully about in The Road to Wellville. And the older brother, John, was this sort of health food impresario, ran this huge spa that was like a combination cruise ship, Chautauqua, where all of the rich and famous came to see and be seen and go on his absolutely insane diets and exercises. Now, his younger brother, Will, went to work for his older brother, John, at the age of 19. And his older brother, John, treated him almost like an indentured servant, paying him next to nothing and working him about 20 hours a day and making him do, one of the things that he did was he would make him come over and take notes while John was being given his morning enema. He would
oh
make
my
Will
goodness.
he would dictate notes for the day to Will. Yeah. Now, an embarrassing situation for anyone to be in, much less a brother. Will eventually rebelled after 20 years in servitude and struck out on his own, in part because John would not let him advertise some of the health foods that they were developing together. And so Will went off on his own, I think at the age of about 40, and started the Kellogg's Company. And they spent the next 20 years suing each other back and forth. And the saddest part of it all was when John Harvey Kellogg was on his deathbed, he wrote a long letter to Will saying, in essence, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have treated you that way. I wish we could have mended fences, and I'm dying, and I wish we could mend fences now. His secretary never sent that letter because she thought it would be beneath John's dignity. So Will did not get it until 4 or 5 years after his older brother's death, when he was almost on his deathbed himself. And, you know, imagine getting that letter. He was blind by that point, so his nurse had to read it to him, you know, a letter from his older brother apologizing and saying, can we sort of mend fences before we're both dead?
Oh, boy. So. And, of course, too late to mend those fences.
Yeah.
So great range of brothers here. The Kellogg brothers, we mentioned. You write about the devotion of Vincent and Theo van Gogh to each other, the attachment of the Thoreaus versus the disparity of the Booths. So different, but are there underlying elements that somehow knit brothers together, even your brothers with these brothers?
Well, this may be sort of a cop-out of an answer, but really the underlying theme is the intensity of the bonds.
Sure.
And I'm not saying those are unique to brothers, but I think they're unique to same-sex siblings.
Mm-hmm.
Not in all cases, of course, but the intensity of the relationships, whether it's rivalrous, whether it's a brother taking care of another in the case of the Van Goghs, whether it's brothers being so different in the case of the Booths, but also being so tender and sweet to each other at the same time. The intensity of the bonds makes it both marvelous to be together and difficult to be together often. But all of the brothers about whom I write in this book share all of those sort of themes, whether it's sibling rivalry, favoritism, sibling difference. You know, they all partake of these different issues. But I think that the bottom line is the intensity of the feeling.
And as you explored and researched the stories of these other brothers, did it shed light on you and your own brothers? Did you learn something about you and your own brothers that you hadn't thought of before?
Depending on which brothers I was writing about, it made me very, very happy, and I was already, in the brothers that I was lucky enough to be born with. I guess I was drawn in many cases to the stories that had some sadness in them, the Thoreau brothers with the death of John Thoreau having such an effect on Henry David Thoreau, the Booth brothers who ended so sadly, the Van Gogh brothers who had such difficult lives. Perhaps it was a way of reassuring me that my bonds with my own brothers were really as marvelous as they have been. I mean, I think one of the reasons I set out to write this book, too, was to try to understand what effect my brothers had had on me, because I think the older I got, the more I realized sibling rivalry had shaped my life in various ways.
Sure.
And that growing up as one of four brothers, I didn't realize that growing up. How could I not have realized it? I don't know. But as I look back, I think, oh, that's why I'm competitive. That's why when I'm donating blood, if I get onto the gurney after somebody, I want to make sure I squeeze hard enough to finish before them. Why do I do that at age 58? Well, I was very concerned growing up about getting my fair share, I guess. I guess in the case of The Blood, it's giving my fair share.
Right. Family memoir can sometimes be a chancy thing to write, and I'm just curious how your brothers responded to this book, have responded to this book.
Well, one of the things that I did is that I did ask them beforehand whether it would be okay whether I wrote this, and they were so generous, and I think all three of them gave a sort of tenuous approval to it, a nervous approval.
That's great.
And it was a very generous thing of them to do. Since the book has come out, it's been so very recent, but so far so good. They've been incredibly supportive, and the fact that they were so honest when I interviewed them and talked to them, I'm very, very lucky.
Yeah. Well, we're lucky to have you writing books like this. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
George Howe Colt is a writer who lives with his family in Western Massachusetts. His latest book is called Brothers, George Howe Colt on His Brothers and Brothers in History. Thanks again, George.
Thank you.
On this Christmas Eve, families are coming together to celebrate.
And we thought we'd ask some of our recent guests what holiday traditions they look forward to this time of year.
Hi, this is Keith Lockhart, the conductor of the Boston Pops, and the holidays are, well, very, very important to me, and I have so many holiday memories of great traditions. The tradition in my house growing up was a reading of, or at least excerpts from, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, which I still think remains one of the most beautiful evocations of what the holidays at least should be about in terms of our responsibility to our fellow humans. And I would have to say, in terms of current holiday traditions and memories, my wife and I like to cuddle up with a bottle of champagne right at about midnight on Christmas Eve and watch Love Actually, which is our favorite contemporary Christmas movie.
Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops Orchestra, with his holiday traditions.
Stay with us. Coming up, Christmas traditions are all great, but what if you don't celebrate Christmas? I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.